You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the blind and print disabled. Welcome to today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Friday, November 17th, 2023. I'm Owen from Drake University. Here is our first story. Our headline is Public Testifies About Proposal, with the subline. Our first headline is Pottawatomie County Board of Supervisors Public Testifies About Proposal. It shows a picture with three cows and a wind turbine. The description reads, a wind turbine stands in the background as cows graze in a field near Walnut on January 14, 2022. Mid-American Energy has been exploring the possibility of developing wind farms in Mills and Pottawatomie counties, but not everyone is on board with the possibility of new development. The story starts, most of discussion focuses on setbacks for new wind turbines. A new public hearing on Pottawatomie County's new wind and solar energy ordinances drew a crowd for Tuesday's Board of Supervisors meeting. More than 30 county residents spoke either for or against the proposals, with the majority of comments centered on the setbacks, how far from someone's property line or home. Your first story's headline is Pottawatomie County Board of Supervisors. Public testifies about proposal. It shows a picture with three cows and a wind turbine. The description of the picture reads, a wind turbine stands in the background as cows graze in a field near Walnut on January 14, 2022. Mid-American Energy has been exploring the possibility of developing wind farms and mills in Pottawatomie counties, but not everyone is on board with the possibility of the new development. The story is by David Goldblitz of the Nonpareil. It starts, a public hearing on Pottawatomie County's new wind and solar energy ordinances drew a crowd for Tuesday's Board of Supervisors meeting. More than 30 county residents spoke either for or against the proposals, with the majority of comments centered on setbacks. How far from someone's property line or home the wind turbines can be built. The county's wind ordinances have not been updated since 2007, and there have never been ordinances regarding solar energy. The current setback limit in Pottawatomie County is 1,000 feet from home. The property owner were to sign a waiver with the energy company, the turbine could be moved closer, but no more than one times its height from a home. The average height of a wind turbine is about 300 feet. The County Planning Commission recommended the setback's distance be moved to 1,500 feet from a property line and about half a mile from a home. A representative from RWE, an energy company that has been planning to build wind turbines in Pottawatomie County since 2018, spoke against the recommendation made by the county's planning commission. If the board approves this recommendation, the buildable acres left on the 20,000-acre signed on to the project would result in only 9.3 acres of buildable acres, which is a project killer, since Matthew Spaganisi, RWE's project development manager, Spaganisi, said that the project, were it to go forward with the proposed setbacks, could bring more than $50 million to the country over 30 years, to the county over 30 years, as well as a $25 million for the landowners. Mid-American Energy, which owns all the roughly 120 wind turbines currently operating in the county, also spoke out against the proposal. We're opposed to this because this is effectively a prohibition of wind energy further developing in Pottawatomie County, said Mid-American Energy project developer William Daugherty. Minden resident Dick Miller told the board he has 155 acres, and he signed an agreement with RWE to allow a wind turbine on his property. He said, I favor wind farms as an alternative to fossil fuel generating plants. Wind generators are environmentally friendly. We will need more power in the future. There's no doubt about it. So where is it going to come from? Advanced Southwest Iowa CEO Paula Hazelwood spoke to the board to address future economic development projects in the county. I would venture to say at least 90% of the projects that we work today require some type of renewable energy component, Hazelwood said. So our larger manufacturers, our technology companies, where they are coming to us, they're asking for renewable option, and so stifling and restricting those options could very well impact our future economic development. Terry McLean of Carson also spoke against the amended ordinance, albeit for a different reason. As opposed to the folks who have disagreed with your setbacks, etc., that come out of state, want to influence so you want to influence you so that they can make more money. I'm a voter from Pottawatomie County, McLean said. My farm has got its fifth generation on it. Nobody here has said anything about quality of life. I'm opposed to your setbacks because I think you ought to double them. Make it further and further away. McLean said the erection of windmills constitutes a quality of life issue. My son had a beautiful acreage up by Boone, Iowa. Had a great view, McLean said. They sat out there as a family and watched the sunset. Just a fantastic family thing. After they lived there for a couple years, all of a sudden, that's all filled in with these ugly windmills. It's just a quality of life thing. More residents spoke in favor of the amended ordinance than against, 18-14, and the county supervisors would like to hear more public input. After more than 3 hours of testimony, Supervisor Tim Wichman made a motion to continue the public hearing until the board's November 29th to allow more people to weigh in on the proposed changes to the zoning ordinance. The motion passed, and the public hearing will resume at 6 p.m. on Wednesday, November 29th, at the Oakland Community Center in Oakland. Your second story is titled, State Board Advances Rules on Social Library Restrictions. It starts, State education officials will not provide Iowa school districts with a list of library materials now prohibited under new K-12 book restriction rules, despite calls and suggestions for it to do so by school librarians and administrators and a state board member. The Iowa Board of Education voted Wednesday to move ahead with the proposed rules seeking to clarify restrictions under a new state law that prohibits books and curriculum in K-12 schools that contain descriptions of sex acts. The law also prohibits the teaching of sexual orientation and gender identity through sixth grade. The law, Senate File 496, passed by State House Republicans and signed by Governor Kim Reynolds, also requires school administrators to alert a student's caregiver if a student wants to use pronouns that differ from their sex assigned at birth. School librarians and administrators have said lack of detailed guidance on the implementation of the new law was causing headaches as they prepared for the school year, and many have said they want to see more guidance from the Department of Education to clear up uncertainties about the policy. There is then a photo in the story of the Iowa Board of Education meeting on Thursday, August 3rd, 2023. The meeting seems a little hectic. Papers are scattered around a table. People's body language is somewhat unsettled. The story continues, master list not required. State Education Board member Nathan Peterson, an Iowa City attorney, asked whether there was any effort by the state to provide a master list of what is or is not considered age-appropriate, because it seems there should be an opportunity other than going through every single book that's in their library looking for something that may be objectionable. It seems there should be a resource a district could go to and say, these have been found to be objectionable. Should we have it in our library? Peterson said during the meeting. An earlier version of the law would have required the Department of Education to maintain a list of books removed from schools. Thomas Mays, a general counsel for the member for the Iowa Department of Education, said, because the requirement did not make it to final law, he's not particularly interested in recommending it now. I think the more efficient thing is for superintendents talking to each other, sharing their collective wisdom with each other, than a master list of books, Mays said. The proposed rules bar visual and written depictions of sex acts in books, but clarify that references or mentions that do not describe or visually depict a sex act are allowable. School libraries serving multiple grades are expected to exercise reasonable physical, administrative, and technological controls to ensure students only have access to materials that are grade and age appropriate. Anyone who has actually read this law knows that certain school districts have been playing politics with their overly broad interpretations. House Education Committee Chair Skylar Wheeler R. Hull said in a statement, this is, and always has been, a reasonable law. Porn doesn't belong in schools, and parents should be made aware if their child is transitioning at school. Unfortunately, the media allowed certain school districts to muddy the waters with weird rules about nicknames and by removing books that were never an issue. Hopefully, the Department of Education's rules clear any confusion and ensure Iowans know this is actually a very common sense law, he said. The rules also require school districts to maintain and update a comprehensive list of all books available to students in libraries offered by the district on its website in real time, or at least twice a year. School districts can apply for a waiver over the next two school years if they do not have an online, quote, card catalog, Mays said. Only library programs operated by a school district are subject to the proposed rules and do not apply to shared library programs between districts and public libraries. The rules allow for books to have, quote, neutral mentions of LGBTQ characters, Mays said. This includes a, quote, observation regarding a book's character's sexual orientation or gender identity that stops short of being a promotion. That is sort of a safe harbor for classroom teachers, he said. The proposed rules also clarify that a student can be called by a nickname without first receiving a parent or guardian's permission, if not being used to affirm a student's request to recognize a different gender identity. Before the start of a school year, some Iowa schools required written permission from a parent or guardian to refer to a student by anything other than the name or pronoun on the student's school registration records. For example, quote, Thomas to Tom is fine, Mays said. School officials would still need to seek permission if a student wants to go by a name other than their legal name or use pronouns that do not correspond with their sex assigned at birth if the request is an accommodation intended to affirm a student's change to a different gender identity. Wednesday's conversation marks the beginning of the board's process to incorporate the rules into Iowa's general accreditation standards. Penalties for violating the law will take effect on January 1st. Iowa school boards and school employees who fail to remove books could face a written reprimand for a first offense. Additional violations could lead school superintendents being called before the Iowa Board of Educational Examiners for a hearing and possible disciplinary action, should an investigation by the state education officials find the district knowingly violated the rules. If a violation is, quote, voluntarily and permanently corrected before the department makes a decision, officials may exercise enforcement discretion and decide there's no need for a citation, May said. Mike Baranek, president of the Iowa State Education Association, the union representing Iowa's public school teachers, said in a written statement that the board's proposed rules did not go far enough in offering clarification and guidance over how educators should implement the law. The proposed rules do nothing to address the chilling effect the law created, he said. So far, hundreds of book titles have been pulled from shelves across the state, and we've created ridiculous amounts of paperwork over topics like student nicknames, he said. Public education professionals will still continue to spend valuable instructional time trying to meet vague state mandates. According to a database maintained by the Des Moines Register, districts in Iowa have removed at least 450 books from their shelves in response to the law. Many districts have removed commonly challenged books like Genderqueer and The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian. Books that are often assigned in high school reading, like George Orwell's 1984 and Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, also have been pulled by several districts. Education and library advocates have argued an overly broad interpretation of the law by school districts trying to avoid legal repercussions will lead to schools pulling materials off library shelves that should not be removed under the law, depriving students of the opportunity to read books. The Urbandale Community School District initially removed nearly 400 books from shelves it felt may violate the law. The district subsequently narrowed the list to 64 titles after a more careful review. The Iowa City Community School District released a list of about 70 book titles removed from schools to comply with the new law. Lisa Remy, executive director of the School Administrators of Iowa, which represents more than 2,000 educational administrators, said the new rules, quote, support the guidance we have been providing members. And on to national news. Next title is House Ethics Committee condemns. On to national news, the next headline is House Ethics Committee condemns Representative Santos. Lawmaker says he won't run again after accusations of lying. Washington, the House Ethics Committee said Thursday it amassed, quote, overwhelming evidence, unquote, of lawbreaking by Republican Representative George Santos of New York that was sent to the Justice Department, concluding flatly that he, quote, cannot be trusted, unquote, after a months-long investigation into his conduct. On social media, Santos blasted the report as, quote, a disgusting politicized smear, but said he would not seek re-election to his second term. He gave no indication, however, that he would step aside before his term ends, vowing to pursue his, quote, conservative values in my remaining time in Congress. But a renewed effort to expel him from the House was quickly launched. The House could vote on his expulsion as soon as it returns from the Thanksgiving holiday this month. The panel said Santos knowingly caused his campaign committee to file false or incomplete reports with the Federal Election Commission, used campaign funds for personal purposes, and violated the Ethics in Government Act concerning financial disclosure statements. The report also detailed Santos's lack of cooperation with its investigation. Continuing with national news, the next headline is Pelosi husband attacker convicted of two crimes. DePape faces up to 50 years in prison when he is sentenced. A jury on Thursday convicted the man who broke into former U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's San Francisco home, seeking to hold her hostage and attacked her husband with a hammer of federal charges of attempted kidnapping and assault. The jury deliberated for about 8 hours before finding David DePape guilty of attempted kidnapping of a federal official and assault on the immediate family member of a federal official. DePape faces up to 50 years in prison. The attack on then 82-year-old Paul Pelosi that was captured on police body camera video just days before the last year's midterm elections sent shockwaves through the political world. DePape, 43, admitted during the trial testimony that he broke into the Pelosi's home on October 28, 2022, intending to hold Nancy Pelosi hostage and breaking her kneecaps if she lied to him. He also admitted to bludgeoning Paul Pelosi with a hammer after San Francisco police officers showed up at the home, saying his plan to end what he viewed as government corruption was unraveling. A sentencing date has not been set yet. The next national headline reads, Biden speaks to leaders, CEOs, and it comes with a picture of President Joe Biden speaking to a group of CEOs Thursday in San Francisco at the annual Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Conference. The article starts, President Joe Biden made America's case Thursday to national leaders and CEOs attending the Asia-Pacific Summit that the United States is committed to high standards in trade and to partnerships that will benefit economies across the Pacific. He said, we're not going anywhere, he declared. Fresh off his meeting with Chinese President Xi Jinping, Biden also told business leaders that the U.S. was, quote, de-risking and diversifying, but not, quote, decoupling from Beijing. But he suggested the U.S. and other friends in the Pacific could offer businesses a better option than China. He also noted that U.S. economies invested some $50 billion in fellow Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation economies in 2023, including in clean energy technologies, aviation, and cybersecurity. Quote, this is not all kumbaya, but it's straightforward, Biden said. We have real differences with Beijing when it comes to maintaining a fair and level economic playing field and protecting your intellectual property. Biden sought to end a clear message about the American leadership as business leaders grapple with the risks of doing businesses in the midst of wars in the Middle East and Europe and a still shaky post-pandemic economy. In his remarks to CEOs, Biden sought to highlight his administration's efforts to strengthen ties with the region. APEC members have invested $1.7 trillion in the U.S. economy, supporting some 2.3 million American jobs. U.S. companies, in turn, invested about $1.4 trillion in APEC companies. Later, during talks with APEC leaders at a working lunch, Biden spoke about efforts funded by his Inflation Reduction Act to improve sustainability, climate change, and clean energy infrastructure in the U.S. Quote, I encourage everyone around this table to also take strong national actions, Biden said. It will take all of us to meet this moment. Biden also met jointly Thursday with Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida and South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol on the sidelines of the summit. The U.S. hasn't hosted the annual leaders' summit, started in 1993 by President Bill Clinton, since 2011. Your next national headline, also about President Joe Biden, reads, Goal, finish the job, as the headline. It comes accompanied with a picture of President Joe Biden speaking during an event on the economy, October 23rd, from the South Court Auditorium of the Eisenhower Executive Office Building on the White House complex. The story begins, President Joe Biden has a simple re-election pitch to voters. Let him, quote, finish the job. So, what does that mean? what's left for him to get done. Unlike Donald Trump, the frontrunner for the 2024 Republican presidential nomination, who has been releasing videos and statements detailing his agenda, Biden hasn't formally released his plans as part of his campaign. But his ambitions are no secret, and his goals for childcare, community college, and prescription drugs have been laid out in detail during the Democrats' first term. He also has unfulfilled promises on civil rights, such as protecting access to the ballot box, preventing police misconduct, and restoring the nationwide right to abortion. Banning firearms known as assault rifles remains a priority as well. The result is a second-term agenda that could look a lot like Biden's first-term agenda, with some of the same political challenges. Almost none of this can get done without cooperation from Congress, and many of these goals have already blocked or pared down because of opposition on Capitol Hill. Biden has achieved bipartisan victories on infrastructure projects and public funding for the domestic computer chip industry, but Democrats would need to win wide majorities in both the House and the Senate to clear a path for the rest of his plans. Quote, We're going to finish as much of the job as we can in the next year, said Bruce Reed, Biden's deputy chief of staff, and finish the rest after that. Biden's campaign expressed confidence that the president's agenda would stack up well against Republicans in next year's election. Kevin Munoz, a spokesman, described the election as, quote, a choice between fighting for the middle class or shilling for rich special interests. And he said, quote, it's a contrast we are more than happy to make. One other difference between Biden and Trump doesn't fit neatly into policy white papers, but it's core to their political foundation. Biden has made defending American democracy a cornerstone of his administration, while Trump tried to overturn his election loss in 2020. The result of the 2024 campaign could reshape not only government policy, but the future of the country's bedrock institutions. On taxes, Biden's plans are expensive, and he doesn't want to increase the deficit, so that means he's looking to raise taxes on the wealthy. He already has succeeded in implementing a 15% minimum tax on companies with annual income exceeding $1 billion. Biden has proposed raising the top tax rate to 39.6%, the corporate tax rate to 28%, and the stock buyback tax to 4%. He wants a minimum tax of 25% on the wealthiest Americans, a levy that would be applied not only to income but unrealized capital gains. The idea, which Biden called the, quote, billionaire minimum income tax, could prove difficult to put in place, not to mention extremely hard to push through Congress, given Republican opposition to higher taxes. The next piece on gun rights comes with a picture accompanied of assault-style weapons displayed for sale at Capital City Arms Supply on January 16, 2013 in Springfield, Illinois. On gun violence, the White House recently announced a new office dedicated to preventing gun violence. Biden also signed a legislation that's intended to help officials keep guns out of the hands of domestic abusers and other dangerous people. But Biden's biggest goal, a ban on so-called assault weapons, remains out of reach because of Republican opposition. Such a ban was in place from 1994 to 2004, but it wasn't extended after it expired. Although the proposal has been spelled out in detail, it would likely affect the popular high-powered weapons such as the AR-15, which can shoot dozens of bullets at a fast pace. Another item on the wish list is universal background checks, which increase scrutiny of sales conducted through gun shows or other unlicensed avenues. On social services and healthcare, Biden's original signature plan was known as Build Back Better, a cornucopia of proposals that would have dramatically changed the role of the federal government in America's lives. It was pared down because of a resistance from Senator Joe Manchin, a West Virginia Democrat who is a key vote in the narrowly divided Senate and announced recently he will not seek re-election. The result was the Inflation Reduction Act, which included financial incentives for clean energy and limits on prescription drug costs, but not many other programs. Biden will want to bring back the ideas that were left on the cutting room floor. That includes making 2 years of community college tuition free, offering universal preschool, and limiting the cost of childcare to 7% of income for most families. He also wants to resuscitate the expanded Child Tax Act credit, the American Rescue Plan, the pandemic-era relief legislation, boosted the credit to $3,000 for children over 6 and $3,600 for children younger than age 6. The expansion lapsed after a year, returning the credit to $2,000 per child when his original package stalled. More work is left on prescription drugs. The monthly cost of insulin was capped at $35 for Medicare recipients. Biden wants the same limit for all patients. On civil rights, Biden took office at a time of national upheaval over the role of racism in policing and the future of democracy. George Floyd, a black man in Minneapolis, was murdered by a white police officer, and Trump tried to overturn Biden's election victory, leading to the riot on January 6, 2021 at the U.S. Capitol. Biden promised to address both of these issues through landmark legislation, but he came up short of his goals. On policing, bipartisan negotiations on Capitol Hill failed to reach a deal, particularly when it came to making it easier to sue over allegations of misconduct. So Biden instead crafted an executive order with input from activists and police. The final version changes rules for federal law enforcement, but it does little to alter how local departments could do their jobs. He similarly issued an executive order on voting rights that aims to expand registration efforts, but Democratic legislation intended to solidify access to the ballot box failed to advance when some members of the party refused to sidestep Senate filibuster rules to pass it. Biden's presidency was upended by the Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade, which guaranteed nationwide access to abortion. It's proved to be a potential campaign issue for Democrats, but they have had less success in Congress. Biden said that if his party picks up more seats, he will push for legislation codifying the right to abortion. The next section on immigration shows a picture of migrants who crossed the Rio Grande and entered the U.S. from Mexico had to be processed by U.S. Customs and Border Protection on September 23rd in Eagle Pass, Texas. On Biden's first day in office, he sent Congress his proposal for overhauling the country's immigration system. The idea went nowhere. But the president would want to take another swing at the issue in a second term. It will prove an especially urgent topic as migrants continue crossing the U.S.-Mexico border and the country looks for the next generation of workers to achieve its economic goals. Biden wants to allow people who are in the United States illegally to apply for legal status and eventually citizenship. He also wants a smoother and expanded visa process, particularly for foreign graduates of American universities. These steps would be paired with additional resources for border enforcement. On Ukraine and Israel, Biden is facing two wars on two continents, and the fallout from each conflict will shape a second term, even if the fighting ends before that. The Russian invasion of Ukraine has been going on for almost 2 years, and Israel and Hamas began their latest clash about a month ago. Biden wants to send military support to Ukraine and Israel, something that he describes as, quote, vital to U.S. national security interests. Quote, history has taught us when terrorists don't pay a price for their terror, when dictators don't pay a price for their aggression, they cause more chaos and death and more destruction, unquote, he said in a recent Oval Office address. His plans will require challenging congressional negotiations. Some Republicans are resisting more assistance from Ukraine after Congress has already approved $113 billion in security, economic, and humanitarian assistance. Both conflicts will likely require years of U.S. involvement. For example, Biden is looking for a new opportunity to push for a two-state solution in the Middle East, creating an independent Palestinian country alongside Israel. On climate, fighting global warming is one of the areas where Biden has had the most success. The Inflation Reduction Act includes nearly $375 billion for climate change, much of it going toward financial incentives for electric cars, clean energy, and other initiatives. Biden is also pushing stricter regulations on vehicles and power plants. But the U.S. is not yet on track to meet Biden's ambitious target for reducing greenhouse gas emissions, according to independent analysts. And there's a lot of work ahead to ensure new programs reach their potential. One hurdle is red tape for energy projects. The White House argues that it's too hard to build infrastructure such as transmission lines, but legislation to address the issue would likely require compromises with Republicans, who see an opportunity to grease the skids for additional fossil fuel development. As a reminder, you're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for November 17th, 2023, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Owen from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 515-243-6833. That's 515-243-6833. 6833. From sports, the next headline is Blackhawks weigh in on player death. Chicago Blackhawks defenseman Connor Murphy can't bring himself to watch the video of former NHL player Adam Johnson's fatal neck injury during an English League hockey game last month. Quote, "I never saw the video because I didn't want to watch it, to be honest," Murphy said. Quote, "I didn't want that image in my mind. It's so horrific, and I just think about his family and him." But he did hear the news that police in England arrested a man Tuesday on suspicion of manslaughter. The suspect was released on bail Wednesday. The man South Yorkshire police arrested has not been identified publicly. Footage from the October 28th game establishes that Sheffield Steelers player Matt Petgrave's leg kicked up after a collision with one of Johnson's Nottingham Panthers teammates, and Petgrave's skate blade cut Johnson's neck. Johnson, a former Pittsburgh Penguins forward, later died in the hospital. He was 29. In the immediate aftermath of the incident, the Panthers called it a, quote, "freak accident" in a statement. Since then, people in the hockey community have wrestled with reading into the intent of Petgrave's actions. Whether it was accidental, part of a fast-paced hockey play, or a reckless play that rises to criminality. Quote, "I can't say anything on it," unquote, Murphy said. Added a fourth-liner Boris Tkachuk, "I really don't know the answer." In other lighter news, the next headline is How to Avoid Car Rental Gouges. The article starts, "It's not too early to reserve a holiday rental if you need one, and you can still reserve one without prepaying. The rental car business is famous for its gouges, even within the gouge-happy travel business overall, but you can avoid the worst if you're careful. On rates, expect sticker shock this year. I'm seeing most big company rates starting north of $80 a day on weekly rentals, including taxes and fees, but before any needed extras. Small company rates, usually to from off-airport offices, and opaque rates can cut that close to half," said the author, Ed Perkins. On insurance, collision coverage remains the biggest potential gouge, but if your rental car gets damaged while you're driving it, you're on the hook to reimburse the rental company for the costs of repairs, plus loss of revenue while the car is out of service. You absolutely must cover the risk, but you have some options. The rental company's collision loss damage waiver, CDW, is the easiest, and by far the most expensive. If you don't buy it, the rental company puts a big hold in your credit card, and you have to pay the rental company immediately for the estimated repair and loss costs, and claim reimbursement later. It adds around $30 a day, but it offers one big advantage. If your car is damaged, you just return it, hand over the keys, and walk away from the problem, except maybe having to pay for minor damages it doesn't cover. Other options cost a lot less, but add some extra risk. Your own automobile insurance may cover you if you damage a rented car while driving in the United States. A claim on your policy likely costs you a deductible, and any repair bill will go on your record and may increase future premiums. Many credit cards offer, quote, "free" collision coverage, but most coverage is secondary, meaning you must first collect from your own insurance. Again, it adds nothing out of pocket, and it typically repays your policy's deductible. Because your regular insurance typically doesn't cover you overseas, your credit card coverage becomes de facto primary. And some travel-oriented credit cards provide primary coverage. The card pays the entire bill everywhere. If you don't want to risk a hit on your own insurance, you can buy primary coverage from third-party insurers such as Bonza.com or RentalCarCover.com, and big OTAs such as Priceline offer their own primary insurance, usually for $13 to $15 a day. Rental companies also sell liability insurance, covering damage you might do to someone else or some property, but you need liability insurance for full-time, not just when renting a car. Next up in the humor section, a punny version of the first Thanksgiving. Following is an account of the first Thanksgiving as recorded by a very punny pilgrim writer. It was early morning of the great feast. Pilgrim women had been busy in the main cabin before sunrise, dashing about, peeling potatoes, turnips, and apples, monitoring food in the fireplace, when one was heard to say, "Hard to believe it's already Thanksgiving." A cackle of laughter ensued, greatly encouraging other punmeisters. "Pumpkin sure smells good in here." Being that one good pun deserves another, a woman holding a handful of turkey feathers said, "We're plucky to assemble a feast so fine this year." "Poultry in motion," sang out another. "But can we pull it off?" cried a weary soul. "Yes, we pecan," came a resounding chorus. Is anyone keeping time? Asked another. We've got this, ladies. We're going to give them pumpkin to talk about. Yes, they were sort of the sort of women who would make the world a better place. They were strong, stalwart, and were not ones to take the path of yeast resistance. After hours and hours of preparation, last but not feast, the woman paraded the dishes to the tables. Y'all ready for this? There came an array of fruits, vegetables, hot dishes, cold dishes, fish, venison, and wild game. It was quite simply a gorgeous spread. The guests oohed and aahed. You ain't seen stuffin' yet, cried a robust pilgrim woman. The tables creaked under the weight of the bounty. Governor William Bradford announced there would be no foul talk or getting sauced, said a blessing, and the feast commenced. It quickly became obvious that the candied sweet potatoes were going untouched. This was not unexpected. Silence of the yams. Any more rolls? Inquired one of the guests. You better believe it. An altercation broke out between two pilgrim families at the end of the table. Squash the family drama, Bradford yelled. Family members didn't always see pie to pie, but they did love a feast. Meanwhile, at the edge of the forest, a young pilgrim boy whispered into a pilgrim girl's ear, Stuffin' compares to you. To which she responded, I've had a crust on you. Back at the table, hosts made the rounds with a decanter, asking, Why not have another glass? It was eat, drink, and cranberry. Then it was time for dessert, dew or pie. A chief took a serving of pumpkin, pecan, and apple, nodded his thanks, and said, Peace out. 3 days later, the feast was finally over. Leftovers were wrapped and sent home with the guests. Plates and goblets were washed, dried, and put away. The pilgrims all joined hands, said a prayer of thanks, raised their arms to the sky, and shouted, Whip, whip, hooray! Corn in the USA! Your next headline reads, She's Not Waiting. High school freshman opens new bookshop in Kansas City. The article begins, On paper, the new bookshop in downtown Shawnee, Kansas, is owned by Haley Vincent's mom. But the 14-year-old will tell you it was all her idea, the culmination of her bake sales and handing out books in front of the Shawnee City Hall. She rushed to Seven Stories Bookstore every day after school to prepare for the store's recent opening. A few passerbys peeked into its darkened windows. Quote, It's been fun to see people excited about it, Holly says, standing next to a wall of themed cookbooks. Holly's young adult titles are lined up on white shelves next to memoirs, historical fiction, and bright picture books. The store has 200 or so books in stock, plus a few shirts, cards, and tote bags. With a soft smile, she proudly shares that she's the youngest member of the American Booksellers Association, a resource for independent bookstore owners like herself. Holly sells new books in different languages, showcasing various religions and cultures. She shuffles around a shelf of books by local authors. A book written in Mandarin sits with other children's books. When Holly is busy with homework in school, Mom Alicia Vincent plans to work in the store. Alicia admits she wouldn't be in the book business if it weren't for her daughter, a freshman at Shawnee Mission North, but now she's just as eager for the bookshop to open. Quote, I get to see her doing something that's really inspiring, Alicia says. She's been a kid who is living her life now. She's not waiting until she's 21. Holly loves reading, Alicia says, but she's more of a community builder than a bookworm. She is not the kind of kid whose face is always stuck in a book, she says. I think her passion for books is really about the conversations that people have. Holly must be an unusually young entrepreneur, but her journey to the Seven Stories has been several years in the making. In elementary school, Holly became interested in baking. She approached her mom about selling brownies and other treats. Alicia consented, but she suggested Holly find a charity to receive the proceeds. Animal-loving Holly chose to give their money to local shelters. Holly says she continued to find other ways to raise money for pets in need, so she gathered leftover donations from her family's little free library and began giving away books outside City Hall, asking for free will donations for her new nonprofit, Paws Up KC. She's been giving away books for roughly 3 years, Holly says. She hops on her riding lawnmower and pulls a wagon behind it, filled with titles. Her bookmobile, she calls it. Then came last fall, when Holly began filling a 97-square-foot space inside her mother's art studio. She wanted to sell these books for profit. Enter Seven Stories. Here was a place she could share her love of books. Quote, I really love when people walk in and they're like, that looks like me, she says. She named it for her commitment to highlight 7 new books each month to her customers. Quote, "Those are the 7 that we really push and talk about," she says. She'll have a special display for her recommendations. Holly's age and entrepreneurial spirit garnered attention for the tiny bookshop. As interest grew, so did Holly's stacks of books. Quote, "It was like the size of Harry Potter's bedroom," Alicia joked. It wasn't going to be enough room for her to expand into different categories of books. The pair closed the mini space 6 months after opening in hopes of finding a bigger place to sell books. Then a spot opened up. Alicia brags in her daughter's grandiose thinking, a quality that, for some, only dwindles with age. Quote, "In some situations, I think young people really have an advantage because there's not this sense of limitations and barriers," she says. Your next headline is, Teen's Idea for Cancer-Fighting Soap Wins a National Prize. This is written by Ebony Williams from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Your article begins, 14-year-old Hemen Bekele from Virginia developed a possible new treatment for skin cancer patients, earning him the title of America's Top Young Scientist and a $25,000 prize. Quote, "He is an incredibly bright, passionate, and focused young man," said Deborah Isabel, Hemen's mother, in a statement obtained by ABC News. Quote, "Hemen is both compassionate and charismatic, which are great traits for a scientist. With his curiosity and determination, I have no doubts he will change the world for the better." Skin cancer is mostly found in people who live within developing countries, Bekele said. "But the average price for an operation is $40,000. I was devastated by the idea of people having to choose between treatment and putting food on the table for their families. There are so many preventable deaths." Bekele's soap contains agents that could potentially reactivate dendritic cells that help eliminate skin cancer cells. The soap can be made for 50 cents per bar and $8.50 for a pack of 20 bars. Quote, "It was so difficult to get a bar of soap that didn't just melt immediately," said Bekele to WRIC. Quote, "Persistence is a very important part of the scientific process." Bekele moved from Ethiopia to Virginia when he was 4 years old and is now a student at W.T. Woodson High School. According to the outlet, Bekele experimented for months with various combinations of, quote, "salicylic acid, glycolic acid, and tretinoin." According to the Cancer Center, 1 in 5 Americans will develop skin cancer in their lifetime, and around 9,500 are diagnosed daily with, quote, "some form of skin cancer." Your next article on the Israel-Hamas war is entitled, "From the River to the Sea: Why These 6 Words Spark Fury, Passion Among Both Sides." The story begins, "The Jordan River is a winding 200-plus-mile run on the eastern flank of Israel in the occupied West Bank. The sea is the glittering Mediterranean to the west. But a phrase about the space in between, quote, "from the river to the sea," has become a battle cry with new power to royal Jews and pro-Palestinian activists in the aftermath of Hamas's deadly rampage across southern Israel on October 7th, in Israel's bombardment of the Gaza Strip. From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free," pro-Palestinian activists from London to Rome and Washington chanted in the volatile aftermath of Israel's bloodiest day. Adopting or defending it can be costly for public figures, such as U.S. Representative Rashida Tlaib, who was recently censored by the House. But like so much of the Mideast conflict, what the phrase means depends on who is telling the story and which audience is hearing it. Many Palestinian activists say it's a call for peace and equality after 75 years of Israeli statehood and decades-long open-ended Israeli military rule over millions of Palestinians. Jews hear a clear demand for Israel's destruction. In the raw afterburn of Hamas's attacks, that chant seems to put everyone on edge. On slogan adopted by Hamas, quote, "from river to the sea," echoes through pro-Palestinian rallies across campuses and cities, adopted by some as a call for a single state on the land between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean. By 2012, it was clear that Hamas had claimed the slogan in its drive to claim land spanning Israel, the Gaza Strip, and the West Bank. Quote, "Palestine is ours from the river to the sea and from the south to the north." Khalid Mashal, the group's former leader, said that year in a speech in Gaza celebrating the 25th anniversary of the founding of Hamas. The phrase also has roots in the Hamas charter. The story behind the phrase is much larger and reaches across the decades. In the months before and during the 1948 war, an estimated 700,000 Palestinians fled or were expelled from what is now Israel. Many expected to return. Israel captured the West Bank, along with Gaza and East Jerusalem, in the 1967 war. In 2005, Israel withdrew from Gaza, and in 2007, Hamas claimed the tiny strip from the Palestinian Authority after a violent coup. The story is accompanied with a picture, with the caption, "Pro-Palestinian protesters take part in a rally November 5th to express solidarity with Palestinians in front of the parliament in Athens, Greece." The phrase, "from the river to the sea," has become a battle cry, roiling in both Jews and pro-Palestinian activists. What the phrase means depends on who is using it and who is hearing it. And the picture depicts a young woman at the front line of a protest holding up a Palestinian flag with the words, "from the river to the sea," written on it. Back to the story on what Jews say they hear. Even the shorthand, quote, "from the river to the sea," echoes through pro-Palestinian protests, crackles across social media, and is available on a variety of merch, from sweatshirts to candles. Ask Jewish people in London what's chilled them about the current spike in anti-Semitism, and many will cite what seems like the ubiquity of the slogan. It is a sign, they suggest, that there's much to fear. Quote, "Have no doubt that Hamas is cheering those 'from the river to the sea' chants, because a Palestine between the river to the sea leaves not a single inch for Israel," unquote, read an open letter signed by 30 Jewish news outlets around the world and released last week. And in the wake of Hamas's killing of civilians on October 7th, they're not buying that the chant is merely anti-Israel. They're saying it's inherently anti-Jewish. On what Palestinian activists say, Tlaib, a Democrat from Michigan, who has family in the West Bank and is Congress's only Palestinian-American, posted a video on November 3rd that featured protesters chanting the slogan. "From the river to the sea" is an aspirational call for freedom, human rights, and peaceful coexistence, not death, destruction, or hate, Tlaib tweeted, cautioning that conflating anti-Israel sentiment with anti-Semitism, quote, "silences diverse voices speaking up for human rights," tweeted Yusuf Munayer, head of the Palestine-Israel Program and senior fellow at Arab Center Washington, quote, "There isn't a square inch of the land between the river and the sea where Palestinians have freedom, justice, and equality, and it has never been more important to emphasize this than right now," unquote. On a two-state solution, most of the international community supports a two-state solution, which calls for the partition of the land. Too many, though, decades of Israeli settlement expansion have made the reality of a two-state solution impossible. And the original platform of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's party, Likud, published a version of the slogan, saying that between the sea and the Jordan River, quote, "there will only be Israeli sovereignty." On using slogan brings risks. Using this phrase for public figures can be costly. Tlaib's censure is a punishment one step short of expulsion from the House. In Britain, the Labour Party issued a temporary punishment to a Member of Parliament, Andy MacDonald, for using the phrase during a rally. He later explained, quote, "these words should not be construed in any other way than they were intended, namely as a heartfelt plea for an end to killings in Israel, Gaza, and the occupied West Bank, and for all peoples in the region to live in freedom without the threat of violence." Continuing in the Middle East, your next headline, Internet Phone Collapse. Israel has yet to prove Hamas used hospital as a command center. Your story begins, Khan Yunis, Gaza Strip. Internet and telephone services collapsed across the Gaza Strip on Thursday for lack of fuel, the main Palestinian provider said, bringing a potentially long-term communications blackout, even as Israel signaled its offensive against Hamas could next target the south of the territory, where most of the population took refuge. Meanwhile, for the second day, Israeli troops searched Shifa Hospital in the north for traces of Hamas. They displayed guns they claim were hidden in one building, but have yet to release evidence of a central Hamas command center that Israel says is concealed beneath the complex. Hamas and staff at the hospital, Gaza's largest, deny the allegations. The military claimed it found the body of one of the hostages abducted by Hamas, Yehudit Weiss, 65, in a building adjacent to Shifa. It did not give the cause of death. The communications breakdown largely cuts off Gaza's 2.3 million people from one another and the outside world, worsening the severe humanitarian crisis in southern Gaza, even as Israeli airstrikes continue there. International pressure is growing on Israel to allow pauses in fighting to let in aid, with food, water, and electricity increasingly scarce, and UN officials saying relief is endangered by fuel shortages. Most of Gaza's population is crowded into southern Gaza, including hundreds of thousands who heeded Israel's calls to evacuate from the north to get out of the way of its ground offensive. If the assault moves into the south, it is not clear where they would go. The war was triggered by Hamas's October 7th attack into southern Israel, which left more than 1,200 people dead, according to the Israeli government. Militants also captured some 240 hostages. Israel responded to the attack with a weeks-long air campaign and a ground invasion of northern Gaza, vowing to remove Hamas from power and crush its military capabilities. More than 11,470 Palestinians have been killed, two-thirds of them women and minors, according to Palestinian health authorities. Another 2,700 are reported missing, believed buried under rubble. The official count does not differentiate between civilian and militant deaths. The war inflamed tensions elsewhere. In the occupied West Bank, Palestinian gunmen opened fire at a checkpoint on the main road linking Jerusalem to Israeli settlements, killing a soldier and wounding three people. The three attackers were killed, police said. Hamas claimed responsibility for the attack. Continuing back to sports, a recap of NFL Week 11, Baltimore Ravens outscoring the Cincinnati Bengals 34-20. Your headline reads, Ravens handle Bengals after Burrow's early exit. The story begins, Lamar Jackson threw two touchdown passes in the second quarter, one of which came thanks to a fortuitous carom, and the Baltimore Ravens beat Cincinnati 34-20 on Thursday night after the Bengals lost star quarterback Joe Burrow to a wrist injury. The AFC North leading Ravens completed a head-to-head sweep of Cincinnati and moved to 2.5 games ahead of last place Bengals. And that's far from Cincinnati's only problem. Burrow left in the second quarter after throwing a touchdown pass and wasn't able to return. The Bengals were up 10-7 after that 4-yard scoring toss from Burrow to Joe Mixon, but the Ravens answered when Jackson's pass over the middle bounced off linebacker Jermaine Pratt and right to receiver Nelson Agholor, who caught the ball in stride and punctuated the 37-yard touchdown with a flip into the end zone. Jackson threw a 10-yard touchdown pass to Rashad Bateman with 23 seconds left in the half to put Baltimore up 21-10. Jake Browning, a 27-year-old backup who had played in only one NFL game, relieved Burrow and was able to guide the Bengals to a field goal to start the second half. But that was all he could manage until he threw a 2-yard touchdown pass to Ja'Marr Chase with 1 minute and 8 seconds remaining in the game. Jackson threw for 264 yards despite losing one of his top targets, tight end Mark Andrews, to an ankle injury on the first drive of the game. Gus Edwards bookended Baltimore's day offensively with three-yard touchdown runs, the first made it 7-0 and the latter 34-13. Cincinnati won the division the past 2 years when late-season injuries kept Jackson off the field for the Ravens. This year, Jackson has been able to stay healthy. When he went into the tent after appearing to hurt a foot or ankle in the first quarter Thursday, but stayed in the game. And Baltimore's AFC North rivals are the ones dealing with health issues at quarterback. Cleveland, which won at Baltimore last weekend to pull within a half game of first place, lost to Sean Watson for the season with a fractured shoulder. Now Burrow is dealing with another injury after he faced calf trouble earlier this season. The Ravens had 5 sacks, increasing their league-leading total to 44. Elsewhere in the NFL, briefly on the Steelers, Pittsburgh special teams coordinator Danny Smith says he tore the rotator cuff in his right shoulder off the bone in 3 places when Steelers safety Demonte Kazee plowed over him on the sideline at the end of Kazee's game-clinching interception return in last Sunday's victory over Green Bay. For the Dolphins, Miami released veteran wide receiver Robbie Chosen, the team announced Thursday. Chosen signed with Miami as a free agent in April and was released as a part of roster cuts in August and later re-signed to the practice squad. He appeared in 4 games for the Dolphins. For the Packers, Offensive tackle Brian Bulaga plans to retire from the NFL with the Green Bay Packers after spending the first 10 seasons of his career with them. Packers general manager Brian Gutekunst announced Thursday that Bulaga let the team know about his intent to retire as a Packer. Bulaga hasn't played in the NFL since appearing in one game with the Los Angeles Chargers in 2021. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Friday, November 17th, 2023. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 3 p.m. I'm Owen from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.